This is another iRaw podcast.
I think geography really gives us a wonderful window into these kind of intimate relationships. So if we think about like different scales of intimacy, different ways that intimacy manifests, you know, there's a sort of like spatial dimension to intimacy. Like, what are we, like, what or who are we proximately close to or intimate with?
Welcome back to The Animal Turn. This is episode 5 of season 2, where we're looking at concepts that pertain to animals and experience. Our concept today is one of the first geographically orientated concepts that we have in this season, and in fact, on the podcast as a whole. And by listening, you're going to see that it's an extremely useful concept, one that I think can operate at a variety of different levels and be useful to a range of scholars, no matter what kind of research you're doing. It's both a theoretically and methodologically rigorous concept. And I think Catherine, and she often talks about her colleague Yamini Narayanan too, are busy working through what this concept means. Now, Catherine Gillespie is a postdoctoral scholar at the University of Kentucky in Geography and Applied Environmental and Sustainability Studies program. Her work tends to explore the everyday geographies of violence in which humans and other species are entangled, and she is a prolific and really interesting author to read. Her book, The Cow with Ear Tag 1389, is a must-read for anyone interested in animal studies, and she's also the co-editor of a variety of other books, including Vulnerable Witness, Critical Animal Geographies, and Economies of Death. She has also published her work in journals such as Hypatia, Gender, Place and Culture, the Animal Studies Journal, Politics and Animals, as well as Environment and Planning A. She is a lot of fun to talk to. You're going to hear that we giggle throughout the episode, but we also delve into the concept of intimate geographies. What does it mean to be intimate? And what does it mean when we say geography? How can we start to think about our relationships with animals in a more spatial way? You know, we talk at pretty abstract levels sometimes about animals and how they experience the world. But when we start to actually take into consideration the spaces in which they experience the world, what does that mean for our understanding of their experience? And intimate geographies is, what you'll hear, a really useful concept. It brings together a variety of different scales. We start to unpack it in many different ways in this episode, talking about, you know, intimate geographies of the body versus intimate geographies of place. And immediately after this episode, I just wanted to sit down and write. I found it incredibly stimulating to talk to Catherine Gillespie, and I hope that you will find it as invigorating to listen. Welcome to The Animal Turn. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm beyond excited to have you on the show today. I remember when I first met you, you were giving a presentation here at Queen's University about some of the great work you were doing with Pig's Peace. That's correct, right?
Yes. Yeah, Pig's Peace Sanctuary.
Mm-hmm. And actually, one of my favorite anecdotes is with you, because I remember you giving this incredible presentation, and then almost immediately afterwards, us walking to lunch and talking about Grey's Anatomy for the next for the next hour.
That is one of my fondest informal academic conversations.
Still, somehow, when we periodically reach out to one another, we still manage to touch base on what TV is good at the moment.
Yes, the most important stuff of life.
Balance. It's all about balance, right?
Yes.
What are you watching at the moment? I have to ask.
Oh, what am I watching? We just finished watching Silk, which is a British lawyer drama, which is good. And now we don't know what to watch next. So if you had any ideas.
Well, I'm currently obsessed with the show called Marcella.
That's which a good one.
It's really grungy, and I'm binge watching a little bit. So, you know, in between doing the PhD stuff. So it's good.
Yeah, totally.
So let's switch to you a little bit. You're one of the first geographers I've actually had on the show, and I'm really excited to be speaking to you in this season about animals and experience, because I really do think geography is central questions, understanding experience, humans and other animals. So how did you come to be involved in geography and more specifically animal geography?
Let's see. I went to college for mostly creative writing. I was interested in being a fiction writer. I went to Sarah Lawrence College in New York and was mostly taking fiction writing classes until my senior year, when I sort of stumbled into a class called Food, Agriculture, Environment, and Development. And it was a year-long course, and it was taught by a geographer, and I'd never heard of geography as a discipline. I was interested in sort of the politics of food and agriculture, and it really opened up my eyes to like a whole nother world, really, social sciences broadly, but also geography specifically. And so that mm-hmm. professor really inspired me to want to go on and do graduate work in geography and specifically in politics of food. So I was moving to Seattle. Anyway, I applied to University of Washington and joined their geography program. But in the first, so thinking I was going to sort of study food, urban agriculture, food justice, that kind of thing. And when I arrived on campus, I met a professor, Maria Elena Garcia, who is in the Comparative History of Ideas program at University of Washington. And she really has changed my life and direction of my interests and passions and introduced me to animal studies. And from there, I really found an interest in bringing my interests together in sort of food politics and animal studies. And so since then, I've really been primarily interested in the experiences of animals raised for food and in agriculture. And so I did my master's on the sort of reconceptualizing this idea of like quote unquote humane slaughter. And then went on to study the dairy industry and the lives of cows in the dairy industry for my PhD. So that was sort of how I got to geography. And just, I've loved the discipline in terms of how broad it is, in terms of what, you know, everything happens in place. So you can sort of study anything in geography. And so it's quite an open discipline. And I really like the attention to sort of like space and place and thinking sort of expansively about what those concepts mean and in terms of interpersonal relationships and those sorts.
Yeah, that's great. Like I'm also relatively new to geography. I moved to geography in my PhD. And I agree, it's really broad, but in many ways I've found it, it helps to crystallize my thought. You know, when you start to actually think about materials or relationships in space and in place and how they relate to one another, I don't know, you start to pay attention to those relationships a bit more. I was reading a course the other day about the internet and the professor just said, and don't forget, it's not something that's floating up there out of nowhere. There's spaces that are being taken up with cables and people that have to lend those cables. And I was like, oh yeah. It takes place in space. What I really love about your origin story, though, is how many changes have happened, because you were studying to be a writer, and really reading your books is a joy. I think your skill there really shows through. Cow with ear tag 1389. I mean, I was literally like sobbing, like, "Mah!" It was such a profound book. So it's really cool to see how you've brought your different skills to fruition.
I've always loved writing. I mean, really, since I was a kid, I would do sort of summer writing camps and those kinds of things. My dad was a writing teacher for about 45 years, and he really taught me so much, like at home, in addition to what I was learning in school. So it's just always been really core to who I am, and it's been I don't know. I've loved getting to use that to sort of express things that I feel are really important for people to know about, what happens to animals and those kinds of things. So,
yeah. And it's a really profound, because I think you managed to take what are personal stories and relate them to science and to knowledge and the ways in which knowledge is generated in really fine detail. So one of the stories that you speak about quite often, and is the title of your one book, is Cow with tag 1389. Could you possibly tell us a little bit about that story?
Sure. Yeah. So this was a cow that I encountered in my research on the dairy industry. I had had trouble getting access to spaces of dairy production, and so one of my primary research sites ended up being farmed animal auction yards, and there are different kinds of auctions for animals in the dairy industry. One is a dairy market auction, where the animals who are going back into the dairy industry are sort of circulated as capital, sold, bought and sold. Another is the what's called the cull market auction, where cows who've been culled from the herd, who are no longer productive for milk production, are sold for slaughter. So this is a very, these spaces are really just profoundly sad, really. It's the speed at which the cows move through the space, it's just so sort of almost industrialized, like, and the animals become really abstracted in those spaces because the speed is so fast, because they're being sold per 100 pounds of weight, they're already sort of conceptualized as meat and priced accordingly. So I'm sitting there in the auction watching all of these cows go through the auction ring, and one cow enters the ring who with ear tag 1389, and she is in really bad shape. She's very emaciated, quite bony. She's limping badly. She's really covered in sort of wounds and abrasions. Her udders are hanging to the ground, really red with mastitis and infection of the udders. And when she enters the ring, they try to keep the cows moving in circles while the audience bids, and so they're moving her around, and she actually collapses in the ring and can't get up. And the workers in the ring try to urge her up. They can't get her off the ground, so they continue auctioning cows around her. They let more cow after cow into the ring, and one of the cows who comes in is quite really spooked, sort of running quickly around, scares the cow with ear tag 1389. It finally motivates her to get up. They send her out the door. I should have said that while they're auctioning her, no one bids on her before she collapses. They actually have to lower the price, and she doesn't sell for $35. They've gotten the price for her whole life down to $35. So she doesn't sell. Then she collapsed. That was an important part of that story. So she goes, they move her out of the auction ring. She is led back into the pens behind the auction ring. And I thought about her all evening, had nightmares about her that night, what happened to her, what happens when a cow doesn't sell. And so I called the next morning to see if she was still there, available to buy, and I had ideas about trying to rescue her from the space. And the auction employee said that she had died at the auction that night. And wow. So, she just was really, a poignant individual who made herself present in the research, and was such a sort of symbol to me of the how worn out animals in the dairy industry are by this commodification process, how it just extracts every bit of life energy.
What a profound story. And the minute you said that she wouldn't sell for $35, like, I just had goosebumps everywhere, to just think that, I've got a companion animal at home, Linus, and to save him or help him, I'd move mountains, because I see him as Linus, right? Mm-hmm. As an individual who has these kinds of interests. And I think so much of what you're saying, and often what you do in these stories, is you bring that individual out through the abstraction. I also recall a story about, what's her name, Sadie?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That you started, so an older cow that had been through a whole very different experience to cow 1389. And, it's an incredible skill. So you've brought this kind of geography in place. And you inspired me to actually go to an agricultural fair myself last year. And I went and I sat in one and I watched, because I'd never heard of 4-H before. Mm-hmm. Coming from South Africa, it's not something I was aware of, or at least it wasn't something in my circles. And I sat in this agricultural fair and was kind of the mundaneness of it was really profound. Mm-hmm. So I know that one thing you've discussed before is how different it is seeing, like you see these cows differently. So some might see them, you spoke about weight and as commodification, but you see them as individuals, as beings. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
And I think it shows so beautifully in your work. And this takes us somewhat to the concept and the focus of today, in thinking about how we can know animals or understand their experience. A concept or an idea you've played with a bit has been the idea of intimate geographies. What do you mean when you say intimate geography?
That's a great question. it's interesting because my good friend and colleague Yamini Narayanan at Deakin University in Melbourne, Australia, she and I are actually actively sort of thinking through this together and putting together a call for papers, actually. But I think about it in the sense of that I've always been really interested in the mundane, in the everyday. And that was really actually one of the reasons I wanted to focus on dairy was, one, I saw it as sort of an understudied area of animal production for food in terms of critical animal studies, but also because it's just so like milk and dairy consumption is so ubiquitous that it just sort of recedes into the like fabric of everyday life. And so mm-hmm. I'm interested in sort of like uncovering the sort of complexities and the violences that manifest in our everyday practices that are so normalized that we don't even notice them.
It's quite a feminist orientation, right? Like focusing on the everyday, the taken for granted. That's quite a feminist framing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that famous feminist adage, like making the familiar strange mm-hmm. or the personal, political, or what have you. So I think with that everyday sort of everyday focus. I'm working on a new book right now on sort of witnessing kind of everyday geographies of kind of intimate encounter. And so I think geography really gives us a wonderful window into these kind of intimate relationships. So if we think about like different scales of intimacy, different ways that intimacy manifests, you know, there's a sort of like spatial dimension to intimacy. Like what or who are we proximately close to or intimate with, right? So I live with these three beagles from biomedical research, and we live in just this intensely intimate sort of relationship. And part of that is that we're so close to each other in the house, you know, and we're so just at a very like basic kind of spatial kind of proximity level, there's an intimacy there. Then I think there's sort of thinking about geographically about the body as space, and thinking about the relationships of bodies with one another, and that what can we come to know about sort of social relations, about broader political and economic structures, from attention to these sort of intimate bodily encounters. And Yamini and I were laughing the other day about like, what do we mean by intimate geographies? And then like, because we were thinking like, oh, are we going to get, because we were thinking, you know, intimacy and multi-species relationships. And we're like, are we going to get some submissions on bestiality? And like, so thinking about intimacy in different ways. But no, we're, and I have been thinking about these sort of forms of intimacy in everyday encounters, like what we can know that we can't otherwise know.
I'm guessing, so with your beagles. I read an article, sorry, a book chapter of yours where you spoke a little bit about one of them, and you said that when you first got her, she was terrified. She wouldn't come up to you, but that for you, time was really important in understanding intimacy. Could you maybe tell us a little more?
Yeah, so I think so. What I was getting at there is that there's okay. So one of the things we've been thinking about, Yamini and I, is like ethnographic practice, and so how do we think about sort of ethnography, kind of life histories, kind of knowing animal and human animal kind of cultures and sociality through sort of intimate and close relationships, sort of autoethnographic practice. And so typically with ethnography, you know, the aim is to sort of spend a long period of time or a substantial period of time in that sort of research setting and really getting to know the people, the environment, the, you know, animals, whoever are there. But typically, you know, this manifests in like, you know, oh, you'd go do research for 6 months or maybe a year, or, you know, you have these sort of finite amounts of time. But what does it look like to sort of try to come, like, to kind of generate knowledge or think about ways of knowing in a life, like in a lifetime? So for instance, when Saoirse, this first beagle who we adopted from the lab, when she arrived, she was so frightened and just traumatized in many different ways, actually. And so after, you know, a few days, I felt like I sort of knew about her trauma in a particular way, knew about the effects of her time in the lab in a particular way. And then after weeks and months, you know, I thought, oh, I have I have a sense of how this has manifested for her. But now it's, you know, after eight years with her, it's just a whole different kind of sort of knowing through intimate lives lived in relation and all of the experiences that we've had together. And so I think in terms of thinking about the role or the power of intimacy in research methods, in just ways of knowing, you know, knowing animals more broadly, I think it really has some powerful potential there.
So would you need to then have to be in relation with an animal in order to be doing an intimate geography? So would, you know, we spoke about Cow 1389 and now your little beagle, whose name, sorry, can you say her name again?
Saoirse.
Saoirse. Yeah. I was reading it in the thing and I was like, I have no idea how to say that.
I know, it's Irish Gaelic and the spelling is really not helpful.
No, but I'm well known for just like mispronouncing things, a combination of mixed metaphors and mispronunciations. So I thought I'd check first. But the ways in which you could know them intimately are quite different to one another. So would it be that one can only apply an intimate geographical methodology when they're in relation with a particular animal? Or is there another way in which you're conceptualizing this?
Oh, yeah, great question. I'm so glad you brought that up. Yamini and I were just talking about this a couple of weeks ago and thinking about, like, what, because she and her, she does research on dairy and beef production in India. And so we have so much overlap in our research and sort of kinds of field work and stuff. And so we, both of our field work has been just inundated with these fleeting encounters, like the cat with ear tag 1389. You know, that was only probably 3 or 4 minutes that I was, you know, in sort of encountering her in this embodied way. But there, we were thinking about sort of intimacy in the sense of the kind of level of intensity of an encounter like that, so that it maybe doesn't have to, that like temporality or that the sort of time over which intimacy can develop in these, you know, close relationships is one thing. But also how can we sort of think about intimacy through, like, in these other kinds of situations, like the cat with your tag 1389, in this combination of sort of like embodiment and also like emotionality, and so this sort of like, I mean, it's hard to know, like, I'm talking about this obviously from the human experience, but like, you know, our both being bodies present in that auction yard, her having the emotional experience that she is having, me having the emotional experience and the embodied experience I'm having, and sort of thinking about those coming together in as much as possible, you know, as much as it is possible to know, you know, what she herself was experiencing. But I think there is something about that.
Yeah, and I think it ties back to again how you see those relations differently, right? So, you know, you're intimate in space and you're in relation, you know, because of the broader structures you were talking about with the dairy industry, you are in relation, these like broader, more distant structural relationships. But like you say, you sitting in that room with her in that room at the same time, that proximity, there is something to that proximity that's worth understanding, and perhaps why your reaction is maybe different to others' reactions, and maybe how these intimate geographies manifest differently for different folks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about more recently about end of life care and grief, and I went through a death doula or end of life doula training a few years ago for humans, you know, and have been volunteering in hospice. Human hospice. And one of the things that, so obviously I've been sort of applying this to thinking about other species, and as well as one doing animal studies might do. And one of the things that comes up a lot in that work is this idea of holding space. And I'm going to forget her name, but there's a wonderful book that's called Holding Space and has a subtitle of some sort. But she describes, this is terrible, sorry.
super specific. Super specific.
I can look it up later and send you the reference. But I think actually her conceptualization of holding space is quite common. But she defines it as being present for what is. And so I think that, you know, I didn't sort of have that language sitting in the auction yards. But I think that, like, I've thought over the years about, like, what is the difference between my presence there versus the people who are there for fun or to buy animals, and sort of like, so what is, and I've thought of myself in those spaces as a witness and sort of being there in this sort of embodied and emotionally attentive way to, you know, the animals. But I also might think about it now as sort of holding space, that those were some of her last moments. And that, you know, whether it mattered to her or not, I think there's maybe something to the sort of being present for what she was going through,
sure,
in a way that had no other kind of agendas or, I mean, yes, I was there to do research, but just sort of, I don't know, that kind of presence. And so I've been trying to think about that in relation to, you know, my other relationship.
Well, what does it mean to see her not as a commodity, right? And I guess that's a negative question. But I think that it's powerful when you start to say, okay, if the dominant way of viewing cows generally is as commodity, or they're not living, breathing, but they are living and breathing only insofar as the industry tries to think, how much can we get from them? You know, how can we get more from them by making them live longer or shorter and make their bodies produce more? So in that sense, yes, they're living and breathing, but only in a commodified sense. Whereas I think, what does it mean? You know, I would never look at my friend in that way. I think we would reel quite substantially if we were talking about humans. And we have, like, obviously historically we've, and contemporarily we do treat some humans as objects, as only commodities. And I think it raises important questions. And yeah, I think what you're saying here for me, at least what it makes me think about, is when I'm in space with another being, whether human or other, how do I view them as more than a commodity? Mm-hmm. or not commodity, but in that space she is still a commodity, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And it's hard to I think that's actually a hard thing to do, especially when the sort of normative like framing of the cow as commodity is so mundane, so sort of normalized. Even being there intentionally to witness and to understand these cows as not both as commodities in these spaces, but also as beings with deep emotional lives and social relations and all of that, I found myself getting quite bored and abstracting from the cows who are passing through the ring. That there's something that is so powerful about the level of commodification, the thoroughness of that commodification, and then the abstracting nature of commodification, that it is really difficult to resist, I think. And especially when it's just been such, it's such an ingrained way of thinking about other species. It's like you have to be constantly vigilant, to resist that sort of way of thinking.
Did you find the space quite resistant to you being there? Did you feel as though you, as a researcher, being in a space where many researchers or animal studies scholars might not necessarily be, did you feel like you stood out? Like it was a because you weren't only in relation to the cows in that space, but to the other people there too.
Yeah, yeah, yes. Definitely stood out most. I think I'm stood out the most in the Coal Market auction, because that is the audience there is. I mean, there were no women in the audience. It was all older white men who were, they called them the meat buyers, and were buying like many cows at once to send for slaughter, and so. I've really stuck out. I was very conspicuous in those spaces. And at one point I remember taking my phone out to take a photograph, and every eye in the audience turned to me, including the auctioneer up there on the auctioneer stand. I put my phone away right away, but, yeah, I mean, there are other auctions I'd been to were more kind of family affairs, and so there was a little bit less conspicuous, because there were, whole families, kids, it was more jovial, there were just more people around, and so,
yeah.
But actually at one auction in California, I was asked to leave after the auction was over. A friend of mine and I were standing there watching them load the this bull into a transport trailer, and they were really using an electric prod excessively and had gotten very angry at this bull, and we watched the whole thing, and they then got mad at us for watching, and were basically like, there's nothing to see here, the auction's over, you should.
Incredible. I mean, this speaks a bit to your concept again about intimate geographies here, is that, you being there is almost a kind of advocacy in and of itself, even though that's maybe not your intention, your work is your outcome. But just by virtue of being there, you're subverting the space in some regards. So do you view intimate geographies as like a theoretical concept that can help you think through multi-species relations? Or do you view it, and or do you view it as like a methodological concept, a way of thinking about how to do multi-species research?
Yeah, I think it's, I would say it's both. I mean, methodologically, I've been thinking about, and with Yamini too, the like an explicitly sort of like autoethnographic kind of method, like what, like how do we think about, you know, typically it's like autoethnography is sort of an ethnography of the self, but what would it look like to think about the self in relation to other species? And so, so I think there's a certain like level of intimacy in that, that on a methodological level. So, you know, that could be in the sense, I mean, I think without naming it as such, that was what I was sort of doing with the dairy project and with the cows, was sort of thinking about us together in these like kind of poignant, intense moments. And so, yeah, I think methodologically it can be, I hope that it could be useful in that way. And I think it also links up with what I think is a really exciting movement in geography and more broadly, which is the slow scholarship movement, and thinking about sort of intentionally resisting the kind of neoliberalization of the academy and this kind of pressure to publish, to churn out research, to sort of think about the work we do as product, as, you know, and to slow down, to think, you know, take time to think, to take time to read and to write and to think some more and to do research. And so maybe like, what would it look like if somebody wrote one article per decade? Like, what a fantastic article that would be, you know?
A lot of pressure. I think that's a great question. Like, obviously, I'm sitting now in grad school at the moment, and you do feel these pressures in many ways to both work and produce and somehow create geniusness at exactly the same time. Yes. And there's like multiple pressures, you know, and then you think a few decades ago, was that what it was like? We lean on the same thinkers time and again, because I think they did operate oftentimes slower. And then, you know, I've got bringing geography back in, I think this does manifest in a geographical way too. I had the privilege of doing my master's degree in Sweden. And I definitely, I mean, this is veering completely off topic now, but I did feel a difference in terms of pace of what happens in North America versus what was happening in Sweden. But again, that's probably just my personal experience. I think the pressures to publish in Europe are as intense. It's, yeah. So how are you finding you're slowing down? Because you're quite a prolific, author.
Yeah, I've not been very successful at slowing down. But I think that it's been something I've been trying to be a bit more intentional about, just in terms of, like I have one paper I've been working on for about 4 years, and I just ruminate on it, and I don't think it's anywhere close to being even a first draft, but it's like I've just been sort of intentionally taking my time thinking about it, and I don't know, there's something actually really wonderful about that, because it's, you know, I've read so much over the last, you know, while I'm technically been thinking and writing about this paper, and so my ideas change, you know, I have so many conversations with people that are so provocative and interesting, and so I think there really is, I don't know, there's something to that slowing down, and I think it is a hard thing to do within the sort of pressure and constraints of the academic system.
Well, I do think slowing down, like you said, affords you to look at a single idea over time, right? To consider it more deeply across time. And this makes me think again now about intimate geographies, but relating it to the idea of history now. So the ways in which, as you know, I'm also doing research on cows, but instead I've got a bit of a historical focus. Mm-hmm. And now I wonder to what extent a concept like intimate geographies could be useful in doing historical research. You know, spaces in general are difficult to understand a variety of animals, now, but to try and understand them historically. Is there any way we could intimately know animals historically? In essence, I'm asking you to answer my PhD thesis and then give me a short out.
on the theme of sort of experience, I think, you know, one of the challenges in particular of historical geographies, I think, on animals, particularly on animals, is just how to access their experiences of what was happening to them. So one way I might think about that would be, what do we know about individual animals and whole species today that we could think about in relation to like historical accounts? So for instance, in, you know, looking at the dairy industry and maybe historical archives of the dairy industry, like how might cows' lives in the dairy industry today and what we know about them from academic research or even like animal science, some of the animals, I mean, that's a whole problematic area on its own, but some of the animal science, you know, does get at like what stresses cows, for instance. And so kind of applying some of that like ethological kind of research and knowledge that is being built now to like a historical context. So you could sort of, make some
like temporal linkages.
Yeah.
So like, I think there was a paper not too long ago trying to understand, was it a paper? Trying to understand how we could think about fear by looking at the whites of animals' eyes. And I think cows came up in particular here. And then, you know, maybe applying that knowledge that we know now about the more white you see, generally the more fearful they are, and this has been researched, then applying it to perhaps finding an account. And if that account speaks of the whites of their eyes could be seen from wherever, then to use those accounts in conjunction with one another to understand experience. I also think, I mean, I think intimate geographies provide so many inroads in different ways, you know, in methodologically, in conducting ethnography, in doing historical analysis. But earlier on in the interview, you also mentioned body and how important bodies are. And then that almost brings a completely different scale to thinking about intimate geographies. I think it's Claire Palmer who speaks about constitutive practices. And then that makes me think, okay, we're not just intimate in relation, but for many animals, like, you know, particularly agricultural animals, their bodies have literally been reconstituted based on our needs. Their bodies are not shaped in the same way they once were. I suppose ours aren't either. So have you thought of intimate geographies in that sense as well?
Oh, you mean in terms of how animal, commodified animals, for instance, their bodies are being reshaped for improved commodity production?
Yeah, exactly. But also that it's operating at different scales, right? Like, I think that this is an intimate geography in that, you know, their actual constitution, their DNA is being altered. And I mean, in terms of my intimate stuff, like my body is one of my most intimate things about me, right? It's how I experience the world. It's how I feel the world. And then to think that there are animals whose bodies are being altered and changed in drastic ways, that would translate from their first perspective, I guess, it would have massive implications for their intimacy with the world. I mean, there are, yeah, I don't know if I'm making any sense. Sorry, I think I'm rambling. But
no. Yeah, it makes great sense. And I think that's a beautiful point. The sort of way that they are increasingly sort of genetically coded to be better sort of commodity producers. Chickens, for instance, and cows, and just the way that their bodies have changed and reproductive processes have changed over time is really just astounding. And I think, like, I mean, I think there's something at the sort of what did you call it? The sort of
constitutive practices, yeah.
There, and then also the sort of the kind of bodily kind of invasion that occurs in what are very intimate, normally intimate processes. So the reproductive lives of cows, artificial insemination, semen extraction, you know, these processes that have been really co-opted and exploited, that are themselves, you know, really, really intimate, embodied.
They're quite intimate, and there's also, I think, a denial of intimacy in some respects. I know that you wrote a paper on the sexualized violence within the dairy industry in the US, and I think in it you noted how many bulls and cows never come into relation with one another, actually unpacking that geography. So to some extent, they're denied an intimate relationship with bulls as they're artificially inseminated.
Absolutely. Yeah, and also with their whole sort of familial networks. I mean, cows are incredibly social beings. They're herd animals. And, you know, the trauma experienced by cows and calves upon their separation, and, you know, this most intimate relationship between, you know, a mother and calf, is really, really severed in the dairy industry and in other agricultural industries with animals. And so I think there's lots of ways that animal intimacies, you know, within their own kind of networks, are really profoundly impacted.
Sure.
Yeah.
That's incredible. I just think that this concept has so much. I think I'm going to have to put down the call with you and then like sit and just write for like an hour, because I really think it's got so many different scales and in terms of intimacies that are used, but also those that are denied, and ways in which you can see questions differently, but also understand animals' worldly experiences differently. So thank you. And bringing those spaces. So we've spoken a fair bit in this second season about, you know, phenomenology. I always say that word wrong. How you can even begin to understand another animal's experience. And then, you know, we spoke a bit about culture and kind of how groups start to have distinct experiences, and cognitive ethology, a method for going out and observing. But I think that this really brings the spaces in which the observations happen into more light, whether it's in an auction yard or in your home with your beagles, or you know, sitting in an aquarium or looking at a fish in a fish tank, or to try and think about where was that animal and where is it now, and how have their own intimate relations changed across the course of that journey. Really a fantastic concept. So thank you and Yamini for this work. And I look forward to seeing the call for papers. I'm going to get started on mine now.
Oh, good.
So I got like out of the window went your slow scholarship suggestion. we're nearing the end. I just wanted to give you an opportunity to possibly read out a quote that you think is interesting, either from your own work or from a scholar that's inspired you in some way, that you think brings to light some of the topics we've spoken about. Do you have a quote?
I do, yeah. And I have a bit of a combo of just a short bit of something I've been writing with a short bit from somebody else embedded, but I think it gets at the at sort of what we've been talking about with bodies, with sort of making intimate those who may not normally be thought of as sort of intimate subjects in relation to animals. Just to give a little context, it's a part of something I'm writing on, encountering animals killed on roads. Okay, the experience of witnessing animals who've been killed on roads is overwhelmingly an experience of bodies. It's not an experience of encountering a living animal moving through the world on their own journey, the magic of seeing a fox running swiftly and quietly through the foggy night, Instead, all we can know is what we can witness about the body, a twisted, contorted, bloody figure rendered dead by human movement. Our own bodies, too, respond, alive, a visceral punch in the gut at the sight, a wave of nausea, disgust mixed with horror, mixed with grief. What can we know through attention to a body dead? We are left to wonder. In his breathtaking book, Apologia, Barry Lopez asks of animals killed on roads, who are these animals, their lights gone out? What journeys have fallen apart here? End quote. Each time I read Lopez's words, I feel a well of emotion, of grief in his acknowledgement, not merely of the fact of the animal dead on the road, but in his call to wonder, to care about these animals' lives and what was lost for them and others with their death. I'm left with more questions. What had the world lost that we didn't even know it had lost when this animal died? Who had these animals left behind? Were their kin waiting in the forest somewhere for them to return? Or were they looking on just out of sight beyond the road, watching as their loved one was killed and laid dying or dead in the road? What, for instance, of a doe killed on a road in North Dakota, leaving twin fawns on their own, who stayed with the body of their mother for 4 days until her remains were picked up for disposal? What would become of them, those fawns left behind?
Holy shit. Oh my goodness. They're like, wow. Like I've literally got goosebumps. And were they really fawns in Dakota? Is this a story?
Yeah, it's a story. I was looking at sort of, it wasn't a blog, but the sort of public forum for quote unquote roadkill experiences, and people had posted about stories they had from either hitting animals or encountering animals who'd been killed on roads. And this was the story of a man who found these two fawns, and who initially, and the fawns were still there 4 days later when they came to.
Oh my goodness. What a story. And the imagery of roads and movement and life, they come, because in essence it's a life journey and a line that's cutting across a road that's moving in a different direction. And I mean, you could have metaphor, it's the extent to which human roads are perpendicular to other animal roads. And that was beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Thank you. And just a plug for Barry Lopez's Apologia. It is, if you haven't read it, it is just beautiful. It's a really a sort of poetic, short kind of picture book with these beautiful woodcuts by Robin Eschner. And it's just, it's one of my favorite works to think with.
So what is it about? Like, what is the core focus on roadkill?
Yes, it's about he takes a drive, a cross-country drive, and he encounters so many animals killed dead on the side of the road, and he stops for many of them. And those who are in the road, he moves out of the road. Those who are just on the edge of the road, he moves them, you know, out into the forest or the field, and gives them more of a sort of memorialization. And it's just this beautiful sort of attention to death, animals killed by human movement. And and so it's like a little rumination on his kind of poetic rumination on his, on this road trip he takes.
And the unceremoniousness of it all. I remember on my first interview for this podcast actually was with Will Kimlicker. And it was one of the few that I got to do in person. It was pre-COVID and first interview, and the sound is terrible, but it was a really good interview. And I remember him talking, and at some point on my walk to the interview that morning, I saw a dead squirrel on the road. And it stuck with me in a way, because I stood there and also, I guess, to an extent of who I am and what I'm studying, I stood there and I was like, what should I do in this situation? I want to move you. It feels wrong, you lying here. Mm-hmm. But then also all of these kinds of fear things come up as well, right? Like you've been taught not to touch death or dead animals. Somehow it could be diseased or, and then what do you, and I remember standing there almost paralyzed by my want to do something nice for the animal while at the same time feeling fearful. And I just ended up walking away. And I remember it having a really strong impact on me. And then, but what about the animal?
Yeah, one of the, so I often, when I teach animal studies courses, I always try to include something on animals killed on roads, because I think it is such a everyday kind of mundane thing that we see and ignore or forget. And there's this wonderful photographer, I think she's in Portland. Her name is Emma, I don't know if I'm saying it correctly, but Kissiel, K-I-S-I-E-L. And one of her projects is called At Rest. And it's, what she's done is she, when she finds an animal killed on a road or on the side of a road, she creates a sort of circle of flowers or leaves or stones, some, you know, sticks, some sort of beautiful natural things that are just around, and creates a sort of ring around them in place as a kind of memorial. And in one class I taught, so I always include this in class because it's so, the images, you should look them up. They're so moving. And one class I had, they had, we, you know, spent some time thinking about this and looking at these photographs. And then the next class, somebody came in and they were like, oh my gosh, I saw a mouse, like a dead mouse on campus with leaves and flowers surrounding them. And another student was like, oh my gosh, I saw that too. And then a third student said, I did that. And so it was, you know, I think it's a way of, I don't know, it clearly like drew attention. And partly these were students who were already thinking about that and saw it. But I think it is a way of
making people stop.
Yeah.
Mm. Like making someone stop and think, what happened here? Even if only for a moment, that's quite something. And we didn't even really get to speaking a bit about your teaching. You've done such incredible stuff. So that was actually when I first met you, you were giving that presentation on Pig's Peace, and you were speaking a bit about how you teach your students to conduct ethnographic work, to understand the lives of animals. Perhaps you could tell us very briefly what that kind of entailed. What were you asking students to do there with the pigs?
Yeah, so I worked with the director, Judy Woods, of Pig's Peace Sanctuary, which is just about an hour north of Seattle. We sort of built this course together is a summer class, and these condensed courses, so they're quite intense. And so we spent one day a week at the sanctuary. The class was framed as like, thinking about animals and as food, and kind of deconstructing that and thinking in alternative ways about animals typically raised for food. So one day a week, the class was sort of on multi-species ethnography. So I had them kind of do these like very mini kind of ethnographic projects where they were each paired with a pig at the sanctuary, and Judy picked pigs to participate who really enjoyed meeting new people and were quite social with strangers. They spent one full day a week at the sanctuary, spending time with the pig that they were paired with, and then they sort of wrote ethnographies about their sort of relationship, the sort of life history that was known about these particular pigs, the sanctuary as its own particular geography, a sort of intentional community, as Sue Donaldson and Will Kimwicka kind of describe sanctuaries. And yeah, it was just, I mean, for many of the students, it was really radically transformative, coming into this kind of individual relationship with a pig. Many of them had never seen a pig in person. They ate pigs quite regularly. And so it was, many of them were very moved and went.
I remember you saying that most of them, oh, well, Again, kudos to you. You've got students building memorials and changing their dietary habits. It's good going. I remember you saying, though, it stuck with me, was that most of them thought that their pig was exceptional, mm-hmm. that it kind of, there was this cognitive move where, you know, all pigs are great now. Pigs are wonderful, but my pig is particularly smart or particularly gregarious. And it's such an interesting move to do. I think parents do it. I think dog parents do it. I think we all kind of like, mine is the most special.
Totally. Totally. Yeah, when they were doing their presentations at the end, it got to be quite comical when it was like student after student kept saying how exceptional. And it was really a lesson too in thinking about like, no, this isn't just one exceptional pig who has this deep social life and, you know, all of that.
Pig. Yeah, and it's a beautiful way of thinking about like active scholarship and the ways in which we as scholars can help reframe and rethink about our relationship. I mean, one of the reasons why I'm interested in cows in cities is because there are no cows in cities. Like I've lived almost I've started to count how old I am. I've lived a little while and my interaction with cows in cities has been almost naught. Actually, my interaction with cows in general has been really limited. And I think like last point, thinking again about intimate geographies is how the internet has maybe created a space for intimate geographies that wouldn't have normally existed, right? We've got access to spaces and observations and, you know, cows cuddling other cows and cows cuddling chickens or whatever it is, where we would maybe not have normally been able to observe that. There just seems to be a way to be intimate from afar, which maybe that's just my COVID hat speaking now, intimate from afar, but yeah, it's incredible.
No, I think that's right. And I mean, I was just listening to the humane educator at Vine Sanctuary in Vermont talk about this program that they had with, that they're doing with kids. And I can't remember what the program is called, Barnyard Pals or Barnyard Buddies. Anyway, they've moved this online where they do these sort of like filming that, so people at the sanctuary will like, you know, film these particular individual animals. They tell their stories. It's like a regular updates on how, you know, this particular turkey or Valkyrie the pig is doing and what they're doing. And then these students in classes all over the place get to know these animals. They get really invested in their lives and their social relations. They have bulletin boards in the classroom where they, you know, keep updates and things. And it is a really intimate geography, kind of educational geography that I thought was really powerful to listen to.
Oh, for sure. And I think, you know, it makes me think about some of these, you know, there are things now with falcons where they've maybe just had hatchlings and they've got a camera on them 24/7. And obviously that raises some questions about surveillance and the extent to which animals are due their own privacy. Mm-hmm. But I don't know to what extent we've also thought of watching agricultural animals in that way. Like, you know, what does Valkyrie get up to? Like, imagine him with a little camera on his head and trying to get like a first person view of Valkyrie's day to day. I mean, what a cool way to get to know the world differently, right?
Yes, totally. Totally. Mm. Yeah.
Before we close, I just wanted to find out, so you said you're working on a book at the moment. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about what you're working on, and if folks are interested in getting in touch with you or learning more about your work, where can they go?
Yeah, so the book I'm working on is it's actually that little excerpt that I read from, sorry, I've got the cat, had to let the cat out of the room. that little excerpt I read is from the book, and it's gonna be, it has different chapters on different sort of everyday geographies, sort of human animal encounters, really somewhat like autoethnographic. So there's this chapter on animals killed on roads. The tentative title for the book is The Sound of Feathers, Haunting and Bearing Witness in Multi-Species Worlds. And So I'm thinking about like what it looks like or what potential witnessing our sort of everyday kind of multi-species lives, what sort of possibilities that has for kind of transforming, for both revealing these sort of like historical and contemporary kind of hauntings of the of violence against animals, against humans, mm-hmm. against sort of ecosystems themselves, and perhaps the transformative potential of actually focusing or paying close attention to those. So I'm doing a chapter on the beagles and that reveals sort of histories around and current use of animals in biomedical research. I'm doing a chapter on crows, which is where the sound of feathers comes from. I've been developing this relationship with this family of crows who lives out in our little one block radius. And they follow me on my dog walks, and
what?
They will swoop down just above my head and so that I can feel the wind and hear the sound of their feathers, their sort of wings as they swoop down overhead, and then they, you know, fly up onto a wire and wait for me to get another half a block away and then swoop down.
Any idea why they're so interested in you, or they just took a liking to you?
Well, they started hanging around. I noticed them last summer. A parent pair had a baby, and so they were hanging right around teaching the baby how to eat and fly and that kind of thing. And so I, you know, kept observing them, and then I started leaving out some nuts. They really like raw cashews. And so I give them some nuts now and then, and so they have been, now they sort of come around and say hi regularly. The baby grew up, and the three adults now are co-parenting three more babies from this summer.
Wow.
So there's six, and yeah, they're just incredible. One of the times I left out some nuts, they were molting last summer, and so their feathers were all over the place, and I picked up this feather from our driveway and was looking at it, and ended up taking it inside. But one of the crows was watching me from the wire above do this, and then the next day I came out and gave them a few nuts, and they flew down into the tree right above where I'd put the nuts, and had one of them had a feather, a really beautiful crow feather, clutched in their claw, and looked at me, and then dropped sort of intentionally, like opened their
face
and dropped the feather right next to the nuts, hopped down, took some nuts, flew off. And it just seemed like this, I mean, I don't know, it seemed like a little feather gift, like they had seen.
That's wild.
Yeah.
I've always struggled, like, what a beautiful story. And I think that food often provides us these, like, you know, spaces for intimacy or opportunities for intimacy. But it's something I've also often struggled with, where I'm wary about giving food to animals that are in my area. I don't want them to become dependent. And it's, you know, there are a lot of seagulls about here, and I think they're incredibly smart and opportunistic, and they figure out problems all the time. But yet I've always stopped myself from giving them anything. How have you I think I could talk to you for days. This is the last thing. I guess we can't be perfect all the time, and sometimes you're just going to make friendships, and maybe we would have lunch with our friends. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. It's something I actually think about constantly, and whether or not that's ethical or the right thing to do, or I've tried not to make it sort of regular, mm-hmm. and I've tried to be especially attentive to like when they're raising the babies, not
okay.
creating a condition, like, so the young crows need to learn to forage and find their own food
for themselves,
on their own. And so I think crows are scavengers, so I think as long as they, you know, when they need to learn how to scavenge and to find food in contexts where it might be difficult. And so I think not creating that dependency, not creating that sort mm-hmm. of regular, like, oh, I know if I just go hang out here, she'll just come out.
I mean, it's a beautiful relationship. And again, I try to dial it back to like friendships with human friends. If I were to buy lunch for my human friends every single day, I might develop a dependency of sorts where it's expected that I will get you lunch. And that's not a healthy relationship. But it sounds as though you've got this beautiful thing going with the crows on your walks and giving you feathers. So Sounding Feathers, you said, is the name, potential working title.
Yeah, Sound of Feathers.
Awesome. And if people want to learn more or get in touch with you, where can they find out more about you?
I guess the easiest is I have a website. It's KatherineAGillespie.com, KatherineAGillespie.com.
I'll put it on the webpage too.
Okay. And it's, yeah, my email is there, and I would love to hear from everyone.
Well, thank you so much. It's been a real treat chatting with you. I think we should just chat all the time.
Yeah, I'd love that.
It's been really fun connecting with you, and thank you so much for joining me today. I look forward to the book.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you again to Katherine Gillespie for joining me in this episode. A huge thank you to Jeremy John for the logo and Gordon Clark for the bed music. And as always, a big thank you to Animals and Philosophy, Politics, Law and Ethics, Apple, for sponsoring this podcast. In our next episode, I'm going to be speaking to Lauren Corman about the idea of interspecies subjectivity. We've been speaking a lot about individual experiences of the world and even about how bodies experience the world. But what does it mean when we start to bring these experiences together? I think that we started to get a glimpse into that when we were talking about animal culture. So what does interspecies subjectivity mean? I don't know. Join me in the next episode to find out. I'll see you then. This is The Animal Turn with me, Claudia Hirschenfelder.
For more great iRaw podcasts, visit iRawPod.com. That's IROARPOD.com.